The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Final hour, the final show right here on 710 KNUS. It's me, George Brockler, on The George Show. It's our second day of June. Whatever beginning of the month promises you made to yourself, try to keep them alive at least through this weekend. Now, keeping with the theme of the day, which has been so much about crime, I invited on friend of the show, friend of mine. He has had a recent huge victory in the courtroom, which is no surprise. His name is Michael Allen. He's the super DA from the 4th Judicial District. Sir, thanks for coming on the air.
Thanks for having me, George. It's always a pleasure.
Now, listen, I watched you, buddy, do this trial, for bits and pieces of it. I couldn't watch every single day, but you just had convicted Letitia Strauch. That name may be familiar to folks, but they may not know exactly what happened. Tell us what this case was about.
So Letitia Strauch was a stepmother married to Al Strauch, who was a National Guard. He's still in the National Guard. He had two kids from a previous marriage. One was Gannon Strauch. The other is Lena Strauch. And the stepmother really just had it out for Gannon Strauch and killed him a little over 3 years ago. But she did it in a way that was particularly heinous. She burned him. She stabbed him. She hit him over the head with a blunt object. Shot at him three times, hitting him one time in the jaw that killed him, and then put his broken body into a suitcase and drove it across the country and threw it over a bridge down in Pensacola, Florida, hoping that nobody would ever find it. Coincidentally, that bridge that she threw it over is a river that flows into the Gulf of Mexico. Thanks to Providence, he did not flow out into the Gulf of Mexico, because that would have left a big hole in the case. And we were lucky enough to get his remains brought back and have that evidence for trial.
That's a great summary. I don't know why I put the R in her last name, Strauch. Do you think, absent that discovery by that, I think it was a road worker or a construction person, yeah, or someone that found it, absent that discovery, do you think you would have been able to move forward with a prosecution?
I think we would have been able to move forward, but as you know, as a very experienced prosecutor, a no-body homicide case
is tough.
Really tough, and that's where we were. We actually filed the case before we found his body, just because of the mounting evidence that was, in my mind, it started to sort of tip over into that. We've got now enough evidence to file the charges. But that was a huge, huge win for the investigation when the guy that you talked about, Macon Ponder, who would only inspect that bridge once every 2 years.
Wow.
If he had come to that bridge, you know, a month and a half prior to this, or maybe 2 years down the road from this, it's very likely we don't find Gannon's body down there.
Buddy, that's providential. That's providential.
Isn't it? I mean, yeah. And I mentioned that in the after-trial press conference, that really, that's God's fingerprints on a case in my mind. That stuff just doesn't happen.
Now, listen, I remember even going down and some of my investigators who just gave up their time, and they're like, hey, boss, we're going to go down and help Sheriff Elder and the other folks that are doing these big searches down there, mm-hmm, in Colorado Springs. If you remember that, we didn't know where the kid was. We just knew he was missing, and we thought probably something happened. And so there was this great outpouring of just volunteers from everywhere, mm-hmm, in the community to go walk this area. And I remember doing that and coming up with nothing and thinking, when are we ever going to find this poor boy? Because at that time, I convinced myself, I don't think we're going to find Gannon alive. Just when, mm-hmm, are we going to find this boy and be able to hold this woman accountable? Do you remember the day that you got the phone call or someone came into your office and said, hey, boss, we got him?
Yeah, I mean, there was a few different moments like that. I think you were still the DA when this thing first kicked off.
I was
still a senior deputy DA. Yeah. And so there were actually searches, pretty extensive searches in southern Douglas County, so up in the 18th Judicial District. And that's where we found a board that was propped up under a tree, sort of off the road, just on the southern edge of Douglas County.
Yeah, that's right.
And it had a blood stain on it, which turned out to be Gannon's blood. And we then were able to track using, you know, cell phone technology, telematics from vehicles and that kind of thing to show that she was in that area. That was a huge break. And I remember that occurred on a weekend. It had snowed really heavily. And
that's right.
Had people
that's
out right. there with poles sticking it into the snow trying to find things. And they were finding nothing. I mean, it was like, sheesh, like you said, when are we ever going to find the piece that's going to really lock this thing down? That was a big get. And I remember specifically where I was. My youngest was looking at going to UNC up in Greeley. And so we were up in Greeley when that actually happened. I get a call and said, hey, we just found a really important piece. It's got a blood stain on it. We think it's Gannon's blood. And we think we're going to find his body up there in Douglas County.
That's right.
Didn't find it, obviously, because she'd moved the body by then. But yeah, there were just different points in time where.
Do you think she had put the body there, Michael? Do you think that she had been there and then that she went and picked him up and took him somewhere else?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we think that she had done was first she killed him in his own bedroom, which that's just another horrific piece of evidence.
Yeah.
You know, the place that an 11-year-old little boy should feel the most safe is in his own bedroom.
Right.
In this monster just completely goes into horror mode and does all those things to him. But she moves him into a storage room that's really close to his bedroom, puts him into a suitcase, and then that suitcase is transported up to that area in southern Douglas County. Then she goes back up there and picks it up, but leaves the board for some reason.
Hmm.
And then loads it into a van, in a moving van. Her brother had flown out here to help with the getting her back to South Carolina, where she was originally from. And he remembers seeing that suitcase being loaded from one vehicle into the van that she eventually drives down to Florida.
Oh, boy.
And she acts all sketchy about it. He says, oh, you're struggling with that suitcase. Let me help you with that. She's like, no, don't touch it. I got it. There's just softball equipment in here.
Weird. And
it was crazy. Yeah.
The case itself, when it finally is going to go to trial, and I don't know if you're at liberty to talk about the background stuff at all or not, but was there ever any thought in your mind that there would be a plea bargain that was appropriate in this case?
Probably very similar to you, George. In a case like that, that's just so horrific, you go into it thinking there's no way
right.
I'm going to be good with a plea as a prosecutor. This person needs to face the ultimate punishment
right.
that we can get through the judicial system. So we took that approach very early on, getting this thing prepared for trial. We did have a very, very brief discussion with defense team, and they said, well, if you're going to offer her something that's less than life, then maybe we'll talk. And I said, well, I'm not going to do that. So it never really got off beyond just that very, very small initial conversation with defense. And so it was, in my mind, always going to be a trial case.
We're talking with Michael Allen, District Attorney for the 4th Judicial District. Why keep yourself on that case, man? You're running the big office. It's one of the biggest or the biggest in the state of Colorado. There's a lot of other great prosecutors that you have on the team. Why you?
Well, first of all, at the time I was a senior deputy down here. And I was with the case from essentially the very beginning. And so that organic knowledge that you get by being out on call on the case and being involved in the investigative meetings and all that kind of thing is just invaluable. So there were things I knew about the case just organically that other people in the office didn't know. But secondarily, I think it's important on big community impact cases for the head guy or the head DA to actually get out there and do the work. Show the people, this is why you elected me to sit in this seat. I'm holding the most horrendous people accountable for what they did in the community. And frankly, it's a model that I took from you. I took it from my former DA, Dan May, down here, who also would do trial work on occasion on big cases. It's just important for the leader to get out there and lead from the front sometimes.
Well, and to that extent, too, you are also the tip of the spear on the Club Q shooting.
Yes, that's right.
This particular case, I wondered in my mind, like, what are they going to do? What possible defense could they have in this case? We found out they pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. What was the basis for that? And was there a report out there that got, you know, revealed to the public that said, oh, yeah, she's insane or she's not? Did they have an expert that was going to come and say that?
Yeah. And keep this in context, too. The idea that Gannon's remains were found, I think, painted them into a corner that they've got to go that route. If his remains are not found, I think they'd probably just go with a straight not guilty plea.
Yeah, right. I agree. That makes sense.
NZRI. But so keeping that in mind, the case was really tight as far as the investigation, and there were no missteps along the way that were going to cause us any issues with getting evidence to the jury and that kind of thing. And so I think they kind of were really painted into a corner where they had to try something, and that's what they fell with. They did get a doctor to come in and say that she was insane at the time of the killing. She's a notorious doctor, Dr. Dorothy Otnow Lewis. She's got a HBO special out there called Crazy Not Insane. She's written a book, but basically she's a defense expert. She goes around the country. She's always testifying for defense defendants. She in her documentary on HBO, she sort of brags about being the last person to kiss Ted Bundy.
Good
as if that's
Lord.
Something to brag about.
Good
yeah.
Lord.
So that's who they got to come in and testify. And you've seen a lot of expert witnesses testify. I've seen a lot of expert witnesses testify myself. She was, in my mind, the worst witness I've ever seen. And that goes for experts or lay witnesses.
Who did the cross-examination? Because I know you had Dave on your team. Dave Young, former DA from Adams County.
Yeah.
You hired him, which was a great hire. Who did the cross?
So it ended up being Dave. So here's the other part of the context to this thing, is that as we're building up towards our trial date in early this year, Club Q happens. So
yeah.
I was planning to do the cross on this doctor for trial purposes. And then all of my attention got pulled over to Club Q, rightfully so. And so I turned that over to Dave, and Dave did a phenomenal job.
Dave did a great job. I'm going to have to go back and watch that. If folks wanted to watch this, they could. They can go Google or YouTube the Letitia Stock case, and it's on there. I mean, I've seen Dave do some things. I watched your opening. I watched the defense opening. I do want to talk about that, by the way. And yep. Then I watched part of the closings. But in between, I'm going to go back now and watch the cross-examination of this doctor. You always hope when you're in that position that you're the last person that ever gets to cross-examine her, because people will be like, she's damaged goods. I can't use her anymore. You know, I mean, she's that bad.
Right,
so maybe
right.
This was it. I watched the opening. Couple things that you can't control that bothered me. One, I'm glad it was on WebEx, but we got to do better, man. That ridiculous camera that was mounted there was garbage. I realize we don't want to show the jury ever, but you couldn't, you know what I mean? You really couldn't appreciate what you were doing or the defense, or you kind of got this partial side glimpse of the PowerPoint that was going on. It just wasn't great, but I could still keep up with what was happening. You get into the opening statement. When you start putting that together and you start thinking about, this is how I want to talk to this jury, how long did it take you to pick that jury, by the way?
Oh, it took us about a week and a half to pick that jury. I don't remember. Obviously, you did the Aurora Theater shooting case. You did the STEM shooting. How long did you take on the jury selection for those cases?
Buddy, Aurora took from January the 20th. We did openings on April 26th. It was the most crazy thing I've ever done. STEM was much shorter. I don't think it took us a full week, but it would have been close.
Yeah. You know, it always amazes me, and I'm sure you feel the same way, that you get these cases and you live these cases as the prosecutor and from the investigative side. You live them day and night for a period of time in your life, and you think, there's no way we're going to find people that, one, haven't heard of the case, or two, haven't already made up their minds. And yet, in the examples that you just talked about from your experience, and then this one and others I've done, you still are able to find conscientious, very focused members of the community who can come in and serve as jurors. And it's, quite frankly, it's amazing. It's a testament to our criminal justice system.
I think it is too. Again, it's never going to be perfect because it's got people in it, right? Like, nothing can be perfect that has us, but I can't think of a better system, man. People have talked about, what about professional jurors? What about, no, I like our system a lot. Let me get to the point though. You were with these people for a couple weeks or so. You're standing up, you're going to do this opening. You've been thinking about it, crafting it. What were the points that you thought were the most impactful that you wanted to get out to them early? Because obviously you have this heinous murder of this child. What are the things that you were thinking about?
In my mind, what was important was really driving home the point that everything that she did was a conscious decision, meaning that she's not insane. She knows she's done something horrific. She's done very calculated, specific things to clean up evidence, to hide the body, to get rid of murder weapons, to drive a body across the country and dump it into hopefully the Gulf of Mexico eventually. And so those are all very conscious things that speak to, yeah, she knew she did something wrong and she's trying to cover it up now. And all of those things speak to both the commission of the offense, but also her state of mind that she was able to form intent and knew the difference between right and wrong and all those things.
There was something I saw in the defense opening I'd never seen before, and it seemed so forced and calculated. But at one point, the defense attorney is describing how you have basically just shown the jury all of the PG-rated horror. There's much more, you know, horrible stuff to come. And he begins to say, and it's overwhelming and it's too much and I just can't do it. And then he does this weird walk out the back of the courtroom where he's going to like leave the courtroom. And then he stops, pivots back and comes back and says, I can't quit on my client. And it was, I know what he was trying to do, and I understand the dramatic. It did not work for me on WebEx. I don't know what you thought the read in the room was, but it was bizarre.
It was bizarre, and it was, in some respects, a little bit silly. It was hard not to sort of crack a smile, but you, of course, don't want to do that in front of a jury at that particular point.
No.
But, yeah, it was just such a stilted attempt to make it dramatic and impactful. I don't know why I did it. It was strange.
It was weird. And by the way, I don't think he mentioned insanity until 5 minutes left in his opening. I didn't understand it. It was very much, it felt to me like a Chris Darden opening for OJ. Like, some people think I have the toughest job in America today. You know what I mean? Like, it had that, feeling to it. Question from a listener here. Did the killer's daughter testify against her? Did the daughter initially cooperate?
So the thing that's important to know about this particular defendant, you know, criminals, especially these types of criminals, are very manipulative. This one was off the charts manipulative. Everybody in her life she would manipulate to the nth degree. And that goes for her own biological daughter, who initially was not very cooperative. And it was really actually a tough decision for us, whether we think we could charge her and hold her accountable for any involvement she might have had in the murder. We ended up making the decision that no, there wasn't enough to charge her, and brought her into the case and had her actually testify against her mother. And it was, I think, very impactful for the jury to hear that directly from her.
How long was the jury out on this one?
So we got the case to them late on a Friday. It was about 1 o'clock when we finally got done with closings and all that. So they got it Friday at 1, and then they got us a verdict right after lunch on the following Monday.
Oh,
so they were out roughly about 8 hours of deliberation time.
And how long had you guys been in trial?
Just started our sixth week when we got to close.
Oh, buddy, that's a pretty quick verdict. Did you get a chance to talk to any of the jurors afterwards?
No. So we do have the opportunity to talk to one here fairly soon, but they've been pretty private. You know, we obviously locked them up and held them captive basically for that entire time.
Oh, that's right. Did you guys sequester them like entirely from the very beginning, like in a hotel?
No, we didn't sequester. No, we didn't do that, thankfully. But I mean, you know, you pluck people randomly out of the community, make them sit and not be able to talk about anything. They can't do any research. It's just a weird dynamic. You know, too, you always seat alternate jurors in case somebody gets sick or something happens. We lost one on this case, and that one didn't even want to get off the case. It was because she ended up realizing she knew one of the witnesses that just got off the stand.
Oh, dang.
To have, you know, the main jurors make it all the way through a case like that was phenomenal to me. It just spoke to their dedication to what they were doing as jurors. It was just simply amazing.
She's been sentenced to life in prison. Were there years that followed that sentence? Did the judge say life plus?
Yeah, I think it's 19 years on top of life in prison. She also was charged with tampering with a deceased human body and tampering with physical evidence. And those were tacked on top of the life sentence that she got running consecutive to it.
How difficult was it to carry Dave Young across the goal line?
Man, you know, he's put on a couple of LBs.
I hope he hears this.
I do too.
Listen, congratulations, man. Great work. Love it when you come on to tell us about what's going on down there. Until Dave, great work as well, the rest of your team. And I'm looking forward to see how this Club Q thing, we'll talk about that on another day, how it unfolds and when it finally ends up in trial.
Sounds good.
All right. Hey, thank you. That's Michael Allen. He is a super lawyer. He is the DA from the 4th Judicial District. There's another super lawyer you hear about all the time. I'd love to have him on, by the way, to talk about some of his big cases. His name is Dan Kaplis. What makes him super is not what he does in a criminal courtroom, because that's not his bag. It's what he does in the civil courtroom. By the way, right next door to the criminal courtrooms in many cases, sometimes the same courtroom, depending upon what rotation the judge is on. But Dan goes to bat for victims. Not unlike Michael, Dan takes cases where he knows that there is a righteous claim to be made on behalf of someone who is wrongfully hurt through no fault of their own, someone else's negligence, recklessness, sometimes intentional conduct. And he and Bobber, who I've known for a long, long time as a top shelf trial attorney, have put together an operation there where they stand up to the big guys. They David to the insurance company's Goliath all the time. And it seems like they have more than just a couple of smooth stones to throw, because these guys come back with big, big victories. They bring the head of Goliath back all the time for their clients. If these guys sound like the kind of guys you want in your corner, and they're the kind of guys I'd want in my corner, you got to give them a call at 303-770-5551, 303-770-5551. His name is Dan Kaplis. That means the website is dankaplislaw.com, dankaplislaw.com. Russ and Frank will get to you right after this. I promise. It's George Brockler on The George Show, 710 KNUS. That drink of room temperature tea at 9 o'clock in the morning, it doesn't really do anything for me. You are on the back half of the last hour of the last show of the week. We're going to go right to the callers. Russ, you have been so tremendously patient. Russ, if you don't say anything, it'll be because you've slipped into a coma or something, because you've been with us a long time. Thanks for joining us, Russ from Keensburg.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you.
No, well, my battery's good on my phone is what I found out, so that's a good thing. I heard a lot of what you said, talked to a lot of people. I could talk to you all day, and I don't think you want that. Basically on, you know, the Denver crime issue and
tell me about it.
Well, it's like a heroin addict. All you can do is give them more heroin and easier to give them. You never want to fix them, because that also goes into the medical industry. Diabetes. Do they ever want to cure diabetes, even if they could? No, because they make more money not curing it than they do curing it. They need dependents to keep them alive. Crime, same thing. If they didn't have crime in the city, the Democrats wouldn't have anything to solve with the homelessness, which causes it from there, and then the drugs that come in there. I mean, the problem is, if you don't have problems, you can't have solutions. And if you don't have solutions, Democrats go out of business. Democrats become the victims, because now they don't have nothing to do anymore. So it's a vicious circle that's being played here. And it's nice to hear the cops you talk to explain the stats, you know, what do I think of the stats? I don't care about the stats.
Why not?
What do I think about happening? I don't care about what's happening. I want to know why. And I think we need to hit harder on the reasons why, and the beneficiaries, the real true beneficiaries of this crime and homelessness and everything else that's bad that's going on since woke and Antifa took over the cities. It's pushed by people way above these local cops. It's pushed in Washington. It's pushed by socialists. It's pushed by slave-owning people that need this to survive, because if this party didn't have victims, they would be the victim.
Russ, is it your sense, though, that these folks actually know what the answer is to cure crime and to solve crime, but they're deliberately not doing it because they're willing to suffer, you know, more victims and more crime because they think it helps them politically?
They're power freaks. Unless you have stupid people, which are criminals, then you can't control them stupid people. And if you can't make more stupid people out of those stupid people, that's why there's more homelessness going on and more crime going on.
it benefits them. So do they know what they're doing. You know, is it any good? No. But yeah, they know what they're doing, and sure they know what they're doing. I mean, man not governed by God, I hate to get religious with you, will be ruled by tyrants. There's no wiggle room in that. That's man's nature. He is made to control other man without God. Without God, that is what he's going to do naturally. That comes naturally to him.
Give us one of your prescriptions for solving the crime problem in Denver.
Looking at why it starts, how it starts, looking at the Democrats' strategies harder, not sitting there giving me stats about how many cars got stolen or how much crime's going on or how much homeless we need fixed. Give me the reason why it's happening. Get underneath that. Find out why it's happening. And you got to hit the...
Isn't it possible that it's happening because there are criminals out there, greedy people who substitute their desires for your property rights, and we've created an environment where they can operate with largely with impunity? Can't that be the why?
I wouldn't say we've created an environment where they can operate with immunity. I'd say the people that... again, like that, benefit from that, and like to create victims so they can have somebody that needs them, that is dependent on them. That is the Democrats, like the slaves. These people are slaves to Democrats because, just like the black people, how long have they been trying to help black people? Forever. How long, what have they done for them? Nothing. But they've got them convinced they're there to help them, and black people believe it, so they follow them. Now you got your LGBTs. I mean, you know, sure, we should do the immunity thing. We should do the crime thing. Us on the right side, the cops immunity should do what they need to do. But we got a bigger beneficiary from the people, from crimes and all this kind of stuff. I mean, the last 3 years, since they got rid of Trump and the COVID got rid of Trump, but the Democrats really took Trump serious because he was straightening things out. And I don't want to get conspiratorial. Yeah. But he was doing things right, and even to today, they want to destroy him. They don't. That's a fact right there that shows they don't want what's right and what's good. They want control over people, and they want stupid people, and they want a stupid society, and they want a crying society to do that because there is no other way to do it. I mean, because when people get too smart, like Dan Kappas, I heard him say it before, when people get too smart, they go Republican. When they get independent, they don't need Democrats no more.
Right.
It's the chicken or the egg.
Russ, I'd say this, and by the way, thank you for hanging on. I gave you pretty much the entire segment. Thank you. Let me just respond to this and have a good weekend. My sense of it is that this isn't a Trump issue. Trump has no influence or control over local crime. But I do wonder if you don't ask yourself, is Trump responsible for some of the crime, or is everything that is being alleged against him just a matter of politics? And I think for some people, that's what they conclude. Like, you can conclude both things at the same time, that what Trump did in Manhattan was a crime. I believe that. But it was also also entirely political that he's being prosecuted for it now at this late date. It doesn't have to be one or the other. I'm anxious to see what happens out of the whole document thing and all that. But, you know, when you talk about lawless behavior, we've got at least one person running for office that we have forgiven for every transgression that we would otherwise hold someone else accountable for, that would even condemn somebody for. Now, yep, a lot of politics in that. I get it. But there is a pervasive theme in the community of lawlessness, and that it's okay. And we find reasons to excuse lawless behavior. Until you and I stop doing that, until you and I start holding each other accountable for the crimes that we commit and not giving excuse for it, we're going to continue to deal with this problem. Let me tell you about our good friends at Ribble Empower Home. I was thrilled to hear Brian from Alpine Planning in the 7 o'clock hour tell us it looks like the Fed's going to keep interest rates flat, at least for this next section. That probably means there could be a decrease downward in the mortgage rates available to you. This might be that perfect time to sell your house and buy a new one before the market starts exploding. I'm telling you, if interest rates drop another 2 points based on everything I've read, the market is going to get ridiculous, and supply still doesn't outdistance demand. this may be the perfect time to do it. The only way you can know that, though, is to reach out to the experts. And the experts are Gay Ribble and the Empower Home Team. You can call them at 833-301-SOLD, 833-301-SOLD. You can also find them at gayhasthebuyers.com, because she does. Gay, G-A-Y-E, has thebuyers.com. About 14,000 buyers in waiting, just ready for your listed property to hit their email, and then boom, it's off to the races, and hopefully there's a feeding frenzy over your house. But you know that's on the back end, too, when you need to buy a new house. You need an expert like Gay Ribble and the Empower Home Team to navigate those treacherous waters for you. They sell faster, on average, than most other realtors. They make more on your house for you than the average realtor. Give them a check at gayhasthebuyers.com, or you can give them a call at 833-301-SOLD. Going right back to the phone lines. Frank, you're on 710 KNUS. Frank, what do you think?
You know, I think that guy kind of covered it.
That's it? He took your whole... I can't believe that, Frank. I can't believe it.
No, I've always got something else to say. But, you know, just commenting on the chief of police, you know, it sounds like... got obviously a lot of repeat offenders, and I think these repeat offenders certainly will meet at some time the definition of a chronic habitual offender. And I know you got laws
right
lock those people up for a while, and I from what your comments were, I heard that you were saying quickly catching them to kind of reinforce that, but in a certain percentage of those it doesn't seem to work. So I think the only answer is extracting them from the general population for a while. And I believe that, you know, just like the Democrats passed a law against, you know, chickens in cages, you can't do that, so you got to have free-range chickens. I think we need free-range criminals. And I think they should be put in a big penal farm out in northeast Colorado and, you know, allow them to become plumbers and farmers and electricians and things like that. But if they can't exist in civilized society without hurting people or burglarizing or doing their crimes, they need to be taken out of society for some period of time so maybe they can learn the lesson. I think that you want it humane, but it would be cost-effective because they would be under the self-sustaining theory and not such a costly thing, able to withstand pandemics because they would be open and able to have more space in an 8x10 cell. So I just think that financial pressures, societal pressures are going to push us to some kind of different solution like that rather than just letting these people who reoffend back out into the population of people who are trying to get on with their normal lives.
That may be the case. I keep waiting for that because, you know, you and I witnessed November of 2022. That's not that long ago, where crime was a major issue being put out there by a lot of third party efforts, by the news itself. And yet somehow we had a hold my beer moment as voters, especially in Denver, but in Colorado, where we rejected all the people that were going to try to make a difference with the crime stuff. So I don't know. I like the idea of having a place for people to go, you know, prison that have proven they can't live amongst us. I'm still a believer in rehabilitation. I just think our system sucks at it. But I've really wrapped my mind around the idea that it is the speed and the certainty of getting incarcerated. I mean, and I wrote this column for the Gazette that was out a week or two ago. But, you know, listen, somebody goes in and shoplifts from a store. They get grabbed up. Instead of writing them a ticket, and then 6 to 9 months later, they get some sort of a deferred judgment and they're told to go to a theft class. Meaningless, right? Like, they get hooked up, they get taken to jail. They see a judge for bond. Maybe they make the bond, maybe they don't. We don't care. We offer them something where they go to jail over the weekend, and then we cut them loose and say, next time it's going to be more. If that doesn't do it, we'll just keep ratcheting it up. Instead of letting them off the hook 5 times in a row before we give them meaningful incarceration. You know what I mean?
Well, that is a positive and quick reinforcement with a negative response. But guess what? That takes a lot of policing, a lot of jails, a lot of scientific stuff to correct them, and it takes the complicity of a legislative group and the governor who want to do that. Now, these groups in existence right now, the Democrats, do things differently for their own reasons. I think maybe it's time in Colorado to find or to start a committee like they're doing in the up in Washington now to investigating why the government has been turned against the people are against certain parties. So why do certain political parties here want to do the things that the reason they do for their own reasons? Is there a money trail? Maybe. I think
so much of it is ideological. I wish I could tell you there was some big mechanism back there pulling all the strings, because then we would know what to focus on.
It may be ideological.
I just think these people really believe the garbage they're putting out there.
They do, but it doesn't work. It's been proven
for many years. I know that, but they will give you excuse after excuse. And Frank, forgive me, I got to cut you loose because I'm up against it. I want to get Gary on the phone. That means I got to leave a little bit of time after this break. So, Gary, I promise I'll get you on. We just got to do a little bit of money making here. And I mean, for the people that have you listen and say, I love these people as customers. That guy is Mitch Floria from the Art of Granite. Now, I continue to tell you about the great stuff he does with the kitchen and the bathroom and the upgrading it. And oh, by the way, if you say you're a 710 listener of the George Show, you get the bathroom countertop for free with the kitchen countertop package. Or if you're just doing one room, I've been telling you about that for a long, long time. And it's all legit, right? And you can still check out the great selection at theartofgranite.com. You can go out to a showroom, which is what I recommend. It was an awesome experience, and Mitch is a great dude to meet face-to-face. But I've left something out that you need to know, too, and that is no matter what, whether you say you're a 710 listener or not, this is a guy who gives you bang for your buck in the form of wholesale prices. No markup. Wholesale prices, in addition to all the other great stuff I talked to you about. So check him out at theartofgranite.com. But I say give him a call on his cell phone, 303-386-5919, 303-386-5919. When we come back, we'll grab up Gary, do some other texts, and I'll say sayonara. It's George Brockman on the George Show, 710 KNUS. George Brockler back with you here for the final segment. I got to live up to my word. I made promises, fulfilling them now. Gary, I got about a minute to give you, my man. It's all yours. Go.
I voted for Mike Johnston. I like his plans about the tough shed approach. And I thought of one way to put the migrants to Denver to work would have them assist in the construction of those tiny, tiny homes. And secondly, one problem he may have is, you know, the debt limit agreement included the clawback of $30 billion of COVID-19 funds, which might be what he's planning on using to construct those tiny homes.
Hmm. And do you see a lot of daylight between he and Kelly on a lot of these issues?
No, I just couldn't deal with Kelly is too previously wired into city politics. I know Michael's a politician, but not city politics, but her involvement with prior administrations and the prior business community in Denver is something I don't want to see in the new administration.
Frank, you did it. I'm sorry, Gary, you did it. You got us through to the end. Have a great weekend. Listen, we're going to know the outcome of that mayoral race next Tuesday. Of course, we're going to cover it leading up to and after that. That'll make Wednesday's conversation super, super interesting. That's it for the show. My thanks to Mike Johnston, to Chief Pazin, to Sheriff Brown, and to DA Michael Allen. We had a lot of crime that came together in this show. Let me remind you, Western Conservative Summit, as I've been saying every hour, 9th and 10th of June. That's next week, folks. Get your tickets at 710KNUS.com. Us and the Centennial Institute. It's going to be a fantastic event. I'll be there on Saturday. My thanks to Billy for the great week. I'll be with you again on Monday. George Brockler, 710KNUS.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
with in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.